Carolyn Carrington here.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. This season is all about the mind. And today, we'll dive into rhythm and heartbeats, into the mind in motion, and into the magic of how drums can heal and transform. And guess with whom we'll be talking.
Our guest today is the legendary four-time Grammy Award-winning drummer, composer, producer, educator, and NEA jazz master, Doris Duke artist, Terry Lynn Carrington. She's the founder and artistic director of the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice, and also serves as artistic director for the Next Jazz Legacy Program, a collaboration with New Music USA. Over her remarkable 40-year career, Carrington has performed on more than 100 recordings and toured with luminaries such as Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Stan Getz, Esperanza Spalding, and many more. Her artistry and commitment to education have earned her honorary doctorates from York University, Manhattan School of Music, and Berklee College of Music, while her curatorial work and musical direction have been showcased at prestigious institutions across the globe. In 2019, her critically acclaimed project, Waiting Game with Social Science, earned the esteemed Edison Award for Music and a Grammy nomination. She's also the author of Three of a Kind, a book about the formation of the Alan Carrington Spalding Trio, and of New Standards, a groundbreaking songbook of 100 lead sheets by women composers. That project inspired the album New Standards Volume 1 on Candid Records, which won the Grammy for Best Jazz Instrumental Album, and the art installation New Standards, part of the Jazz Without Patriarchy project, showed at Emerson's Contemporary Media Art Gallery. A visionary artist, cultural architect, and tireless advocate for equity in music, Terry Lynn Carrington continues to transform the landscape of jazz and beyond.
Terry Lynn Carrington, welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
From the talking drums of West Africa, echoing the cadence of speech, to the booming gongs of the Amazon and Indonesia, drums have carried messages across vast distances from village to village, vibrating from mind to mind and spirit to spirit. Whether marking the slow ache of grief or the unified energy of a marching army, in ceremonies, rituals, or communal gatherings, drums have helped shape our shared emotional landscape. Drums are more than just musical instruments. They not only accompany our thoughts, they communicate with the mind in a language older than words. And it is also said that those playing the drums are more than translators of that language. They're storytellers who guide and heal. Terry, you're a fantastic drummer. When did you first become aware of the many roles of a drummer and of the social and moral responsibilities that come with it?
Well, you know, I started playing when I was seven years old, and I wasn't really thinking about all that when I started, but I was drawn to it. I'm from a family of drummers. My grandfather was a drummer, and my father, he played drums and saxophone. So I think that also speaks to how, you know, in the griot families in Africa, this lineage is passed down from generation to generation. And I feel that it's the same thing, you know, with me and my family. It was passed down somehow in the blood, in the spirit. So I do believe there's an ancestral connection. And even when I sat down to the drums at 7 years old, the first thing my family said is that I reminded them of my grandfather, that I looked like him sitting at the drums. And he had passed away 6 months before I was born. So I know that there's this connection, this ancestral connection with my grandfather. And then I believe, you know, further back, of course, from that. So I understood deeply that, you know, the drummers carry something that we're able to bring people into the music, bring people into our message, that we are messengers, carriers of some kind of code. Like rhythm is code, right? Rhythm is in how we speak, how we talk. So I believe that we're carrying these messages, even if we don't know what they are. And I think when I started, that was the case for me. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew something was important. We will sing
our song. You know, I've always thought of rhythm as a sort of bridge between people's personal, emotional, and ancestral memory, as you were saying. Terry, how would you explain the way rhythm steers emotion and ties it or ties us into that shared collective knowledge?
Well, I think that, you know, rhythm is something that can bring people into a trance, right? So it's something that people respond to, and I'm not always sure that they know why they're responding to it. And I also find it very interesting that the heart beats in three-quarter time. And so many of the sacred rhythms from Africa are based in three. They're 6-8 rhythms, which is same as 3-4 if you count half as much, half as slowly. So I think it starts with the heartbeat. People talk about the rhythm of life. I think, you know, obviously the earth spins, and I think there's a rhythm to that. There's a rhythm to the wind. Sometimes rhythm is not constant. It's varying all the time. So there's a rhythm to nature. There's a rhythm to just, you know, as I said before, how we talk, how we walk, everything that we do. So I think there is this collective knowledge that we're all in some way synchronized with, you know, and I think that's what people mean when they say the rhythm of life and the rhythm of the universe.
So the heartbeat is the first rhythm we ever hear, even before we were born. And it is rhythm that carries us through every moment we leave. The heartbeat is life, I think, reminding us over and over again that we are here, alive, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And following with heartbeats, let us listen to renowned artist Rafael Lozano Hemmer talk about his inspiration to create an installation called Pulse Typology, a dreamlike landscape of light bulbs representing visitors connected to their heartbeat. This will be followed by Reverend Barbara Holmes, who will be accompanying us through this interview. She's an activist, a scholar, also specialized in African-American spirituality, mysticism, and culture. She will talk about the impulses that connect us to one another.
An anecdote, my ex-wife was pregnant with my twins, and I learned that the ultrasound machine can let you hear the heartbeat of the baby. And being a nerd, I asked for two ultrasound machines so that I could listen simultaneously to the heartbeat of the boy and the heartbeat of the girl. And they were completely different. And they were creating this kind of repetitive pattern. Sometimes they would be in sync and sometimes they would go out of sync. Kind of like the music of Steve Reich or Glenn Branca, Conlon Ancar, or Philip Glass. It's kind of minimalist coming in and out. And I thought, that is beautiful. We could create a concert of not of just of two heartbeats, but of hundreds or thousands of heartbeats simultaneously to create this pattern. So that was the original idea behind the project Pulse Room. It reminds us that we're here only for a little time. And, you know, as your heartbeat disappears, you know, it's kind of a nice metaphor for your time on Earth.
What he's saying is there are impulses that we don't control that connect us to one another. And there has been other research that says that our heartbeat goes outside of our body and entrains and connects to other heartbeats, just like he was talking about his twins, sometimes in sync, not in sync. So sometimes you walk into a room and you're just uncomfortable. Could it be that your heart is entraining with others who are out of sync with you at that moment? Who knows? But the research is just fascinating.
As a band leader, how do you bring everyone within your sphere of influence into sync?
Well, I think that's partially the drummer's role, but I think everybody's a drummer, as they were just saying. Everybody has a heartbeat. Everybody has a pulse. So the rhythm of a group is not just for the drummer to determine, but the drummer can be, and in most cases, is the leader with that and has, an extra special connection with rhythm. But it really does have to be something that everybody studies and participates in. And that's something that I really talk to my students about, how they can't just rely on a drummer for rhythm and float on top. They have to be inside of this rhythm. And when I say rhythm, sometimes we're playing out of time. But as I said before, there's still time within that. There are phrases and there are things that keep us connected. So that is very interesting about what they just said about the heartbeat being in sync and then moving away and coming back. And that's kind of the beauty. That creates, you know, texture, it creates conversation. So I think that we're doing that. I never put terminology to it, but that's exactly what we're doing. We're coming in sync and out of sync constantly with each other. But the drummer is, I guess, sometimes the de facto leader of a group, even if it's not their group. You know, we're still kind of able to help shape the rise and fall of a piece of music, help shape those kinds of connections when we are in sync and out of sync. We also can purposely go out of sync with whatever is happening that is in sync to create those kinds of textures. So I think we know instinctively how to bring people together.
Making all of those variations in coming into sync and then getting out of sync, is that improvisation? Would that be part? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's partially improvisation, depending on what you're doing exactly. You could play a rhythm that's, I would say, tribal, meaning repetitive and the same rhythm over and over, and you can still do a push and pull with that. And that's very, you know, fine, you know, just those kinds of discrepancies. But when you're improvising, yes, you can do things that push things forward. You can do things that pull things back. You can help control the dynamics of a group. You can really push another person that's playing into a frenzy, or you can calm them down. There's so many things that drummers can do that people don't actually talk about. But yes, I think that we have a very powerful role in any group, in any setting, and we have to yield that power wisely. And those are the great drummers that do. And there's so often that you hear, you know, you may go hear a band and the drummer is just annoying you and you don't know why. And, you know, for me, or the music in general is annoying you and you don't know why. And often, you know, I always say that a band is only as good as its drummer, because there is a lot of power, and with power comes responsibility. And I think, you know, some drummers are in tune with that and others aren't. And with that responsibility, you can't be concerned just with your own self-interest. You can't, you know, come with an agenda. You know, you have to be in the moment. You have to serve the music, serve what's happening at that time, you know, support, you know, the band leader, all of those things.
And I think what you're saying now, it let me think that also another role of the drummer is to care about all the people doing music and perhaps those or that person going into a sort of displacement to place him back in.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because it's so funny you say that, because sometimes I'm playing and it's people that are great. I mean, like, you know, like legendary people. And I have to know exactly how far to push them or when to bring them back, not to really insult them, you know, step on their toes, but to still guide them. So I do think we're guides in that way. We're musical guides, rhythmic guides, but, you know, on another level, spiritual guides, you know, whether we go into it knowing that or not, you know, we're accessing a profound wisdom that is very old and ancient. And that's what, you know, we've been given. That's one of the gifts we've been given. For me, I'm very conscious of a universal power, spirit, energy. That's really the right term for me. An energy that guides us. And energy is motion as well. Energy is not stagnant. So this kind of energy in Buddhism, I practice Buddhism. And in Buddhism, we talk about being in rhythm with the universe. And when everything is flowing and everything is going great, now that could mean on stage or that could mean just in life, then I know that I'm in rhythm. So I think even though we use those terms and it means a little something different, it actually still means the same thing. And when we're in harmony with other people, it's similar. It's like being in rhythm with other people. And I think, you know, the idea and the concept of things like, you know, world peace and all of that is based on being in harmony and in rhythm with other people in the universe, because we're all in this collective energy trying to thrive together.
Absolutely. Well, in her interview, Barbara Holmes again also talked about displacement and the link to jazz improvisation. Let's listen.
Jazz is a very American musical genre. It's music that expresses itself as being between a rock and a hard place, as we would say. It says through blue notes, things are a low-down, dirty shame. Jazz is a musical version of the communal response to displacement. And that's not just a Black thing, because in North America, most of us are displaced immigrants, migrants, folk who were brought there. But most of us didn't originate in the North American continent. So the only difference is that displacement of the African diaspora became permanent and was sealed by skin color as a marker of permanent social exile. So there's something about improvisation in jazz that evokes a creativity. You know, it's about taking a little and making more out of it, starting with a few notes and blasting off into something completely cosmic. It's melodic innovation. Now, I have used John Coltrane as an example. I wrote an article called Christ, Coltrane, and the Jazz Sermon. And I did that because when you hear John Coltrane, you know that the notes that he's blowing come directly from another galaxy. You can hear the pain. You can hear the possibility. You can hear the neighborhood folks gossiping. You know, the straining trumpet in jazz blasts away the illusion that our upward mobility will bring us peace. Jazz helps us to perform joy when we least feel like it.
You know, when I was listening again to this excerpt that I wanted to place here and thinking about what she said about displacement, I traduced everything she said in terms of, just in general, the feeling displaced due to age, whether that be in adolescence or old age, in a community or family. This could also apply to having different views, you know, having a physical disability or experiencing mental health difficulties. How do you experience the possibilities of improvisation that jazz provides as a liberating space of creativity and a safe place where inclusiveness can be adapted, a space where people feel they belong to?
Well, that's kind of the beauty and the promise of jazz. Jazz was originally manifested as freedom music. This was a way to let your creativity take you to as far as it can go. The idea is to be free within a given set of boundaries. And then the idea is to keep stretching those boundaries. So if you have a piece of music that, you know, says this is what it is, you find ways to really be free within that. So that's like, for instance, somebody playing over a jazz standard and they're improvising within that context of that piece. And then you start figuring out how to stretch those boundaries. You start reharmonizing. You start changing the rhythms. If it's in four, maybe you put it in five or seven. You start, you know, doing things like being a rubato, so you're not strict with time. And then you start creating new forms. And that's the big thing that jazz has done. It has kept innovating form. And to the point, I think you get to the point, like if you looked at her example of John Coltrane, and you looked how he started and you looked where he ended, and at the end of his, you know, short career, he was just playing free. And I believe that it's a quest for freedom to, you know, our lives in general, the whole trajectory of our lives is a quest for freedom.
Absolutely. He went to total abstraction.
Yes, yes. So musicians have, you know, this gift of making audible the freedom dreams of an entire group of people.
Mm-hmm. And now that you're talking about freedom, this takes me to a very special place.
Whisper, listen.
Reverend Holmes, well, she revealed the meaning of drums to me, their connection to one's own heartbeat and their sacred nature. And she showed me how they foster a sense of community, of bringing us together. But most importantly, I learned from her about their ancestral significance and liberating meaning for African American people. And it was a profound insight I got from her.
Yeah, when Africans were brought to the Americas as captured human beings, they were not allowed to bring their drums with them. And the drums were a major source of communication on the African continent. The drums were treated almost as if they were a human voice. They would beat the drums to help the ancestors to traverse in the evenings the waters as they were crossing from this life to the other life. They used drums for celebration. They used drums as an intrinsic part of the weaving together of community. And the captors knew this and took their drums away. And so African Americans learned how to replicate the sound and the mystery of the drum with their feet. They tap danced. They clapped in syncopated rhythms. They sang songs that reverberated and echoed one another. And so you may take the drum away from the drummer, but you can't take the drum beats out of the drummer's heart. And so if that drum is part of who you are, it will be expressed in another way. And that's what Savion Glover was doing. He was tapping out what the drum would have called for. He was showing his resistance to oppression. He was stomping out liberation just as clearly as if he had had a talking drum.
You know, I love what she said in the excerpt you just played with tap, because, you know, it's the same with whether you're, she said tapping, you know, he was tapping out, you know, the anger of, you know, or the resistance against oppression. And so all of these things, you know, come up as especially on the drums, you know, where we are playing against all of these oppressive forces that have tried to constrict our intellect, because being creative and being an improviser is intellectual. So you've had, you know, I don't know, hundreds of years of people trying to make sure that you cannot develop your intellect or your creativity, which, you know, are connected. So jazz was a means to keep pushing that boundary that kept being set. And in a way, doing it in a way that people didn't realize that's what you were doing, because they didn't respect the intellectualism in this art form or the intellectualism in improvisation in general, because it was actually above their heads. You know, the oppressor was not thinking that the blues was deep, or that, you know, as jazz evolved, that any of this was on the high intellectual level that it was. So it became its own language, a nonverbal language that spoke to not just the group of people that were innovating it, but it obviously spoke to many, many more people and many more cultures, and became such an international phenomenon because of it.
And such an intellectual genre, as you're saying. And yeah, talking about drummers and experts in unspoken languages, you were mentored and accompanied through life by many fantastic musical communicators. Your father, Clark Terry, Jack DeJohnette. Today, when you look back, which of your mentors' contributions do you consider having been the most important in helping you develop such a rich and fluent musical language?
Well, I would say my biggest mentor is Jack DeJohnette. Mm-hmm. He really opened me up to so many things, to other genres, to the ways in which the drums can function in these various spaces, and just also in life. And, you know, I was very rigid and narrow-minded when I was a teenager. So meeting him at around 17 really changed my life. He exposed me, him and his wife, Lydia, they exposed me to so much more than what I had seen thus far. And then people like Roy Haynes, who's also from Boston, where I'm from, he, for me, was the, you know, real father of modern drumming, innovator of modern drumming. And so anybody that's playing, you know, modern in the drums, like away from just the timekeeping aspect in jazz, owes so much to Roy Haynes. So he was also, I would say, a musical mentor. I met him and knew him, you know, from a kid on, but I didn't spend as much time with him as somebody like Jack DeJohnette. Another mentor was Alan Dawson. He was one of the greatest drum teachers in the world, and also lived in Boston and taught, just people flew from all over the world to study with him. So much of my teaching is based on his methods, based on his teaching. And then eventually my greatest mentor in music was Wayne Shorter. And I really learned from him, and then also from Herbie Hancock, this notion of playing life and not music, and that there's absolutely no separation between life and music. So all of these things made me a better musician, all of these interactions, but also made me a better educator. I'm able to, you know, look at the things we learn in the academy, in school. Those things are technical. Those things are really just giving you the tools to then be the creative musician that you're able to be. They give you the tools to push your creativity to its furthest limit. But the tools themselves aren't really anything. Other than that, you know, we're talking about, you know, being a robot, you know, just playing things that you're taught. Now, I'm not saying that if you're just playing things that you're reading or that you're taught, that it's not connected to life, because it is, you know, your interpretation of those things that's connected as well. But in jazz, that's where the difference is with jazz and so many other art forms. The improvisational part, the innovative part of it all, is so important. So we have to be able to have the tools to be able to have the shared language and shared way of communicating. But then it is our own life that informs everything that we do, everything that we play. So I've learned, you know, that from all of these great people that I've been around and that have taken the time to teach me.
You know, my mom is like a super fan of Jacques Dejeunette.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what she said to me the other day? She said, don't you think that when you hear him play that he has an elastic way of playing and that he stretches time? I don't know how he does it. Is it so?
Absolutely.
Do you think so?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, he's the person that told me that, you know, we have to be free within a given set of boundaries. So if he's looking at a boundary of being one bar or one beat or four bars or four or six beats, whatever it is, he's trying to find a freedom within that short period of time, as well as in, you know, a macro sense of a whole song or a whole, you know, or conceptually, but also like having a big pulse. And that goes back to the heartbeat, right? You know, the heartbeat isn't exact all the time. You know, the heartbeat is in rhythm, but it's a rhythm that has flexibility. And you have to have that kind of flexibility in life as well. So that is all totally connected. Because if we are rigid, then that's the same as just machines, you know, making music. So it's the life part, the breath. When we breathe, it's in rhythm, but it's not exact, you know? So Jack's playing represents that. It references all of that. He's in time, but he's finding all of this space and all of this flexibility, just like your mom said, within this time. And he's doing it with being in rhythm with the time of what's going on around him. You know,
that sounds fantastic. I mean, I can just visualize you like riding in a wave with him going into, holding his hand and going and grabbing the perfect wave.
Absolutely. Well, water is, I mean, I always use that analogy, actually, analogy of waves. And that's what we're doing. You know, we're creating this wave motion in time opposed to a straight line. You know, again, that reflects, like, even when you're born, you're in water. You know, everything is in motion. So if you're kind of flexible like that and you can float, you're able to be, you know, in a time while these waves are still churning under and not, or within, and not, you know, not it being so metric that there's no flow in and out of something. And that's, you know, the difference between human beings and machines, and why machines will never completely replace human beings.
Yeah, and so a way of becoming aware where you're stuck, right? Probably when you're like not in the flow. And what a wonderful thing to have somebody that can free you from those intellectual barriers and clear up the way a little bit.
No? Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think it's your job. I don't think anybody else is really freeing you. I think that, you know, it's our own job to figure this out, because it's self-discovery. I believe nobody can actually really teach you. You know, as I mentioned, you know, we have tools that we can teach, but nobody can actually teach you how to play. That is the job of self-discovery. And that's what makes everybody individual. But we do have guides, and I think that's what our mentors are for. And at some point, you know, it's an exchange. We teach our mentors as well. All of my students teach me. But, you know, it's this willingness to expand. You know, all the great musicians, drummers or whomever, have a willingness to expand constantly. You know, not be just, you know, rigid or stuck in their ways. Even if you can't hear it with some people, I think innately, there's this willingness to know more, to expand, you know, intellectually, creatively, but also within our instruments. So what you say is great about getting stuck. And that's actually a blessing, because when we get stuck, then we use this practice of music, because music is a practice. We use this practice to get unstuck. And then we feel so victorious when we're able, you know, to do that. And when we're aware of these things. And often when we get stuck, it's because of habits, you know, because of being habitual. And then we have to keep unlearning, you know, things that we've learned so that we can continually expand.
Well, and that brings us into empathy, because I think in these different exchanges, there's a lot of empathy of human, how do you say it? Like, you can understand better what's going on in your mentor is understanding better what's going on in the students, and it's just everything above level of love too, right?
Mm. Yeah, that's what teaching is. You know, teaching is showing love and care for the student, but for humanity, you know, and for yourself. As I said, it is an exchange, and we learn and grow from our exchanges with others. So I don't look at it as hierarchical, but empathy, yes, is a big, big part of it, empathy and compassion. I would have these conversations with Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, and those are the things we would talk about, not like something technical, not, you know, when you go to the bridge, play this. We don't talk like that. You know, we really do talk about the life condition of others, the life condition of ourselves, how we can better humanity, we can inspire humanity, how we are in tune with humanity, and it is the humanity and others that we're constantly in conversation with and what we connect with when we play. So when we have a good concert, you know, it's that energy is felt because, as you said with the heartbeat, you know, it's similar, right? We're in tune with the heartbeat of others. And even when we don't have a good concert, people will come up and say, oh my God, this changed my life and this did so much. And I used to say, oh God, it was terrible. I did so poorly. But now I've learned to say thank you because I realized that they know something and they're connected to something that I don't. And when I'm saying it was bad, I'm thinking on the technical. Mm-hmm. And so I had to learn to think beyond the technical to know that my life could touch someone else's life through sound, through rhythm.
Well, thank you so much for letting us into these insights of these great conversations of all of you great musicians. And you know, there was even a study, I think in 2018, that was published in the Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Journal by Rajani and his team, which I will paste the link. I will paste it in this episode's description if anybody is interested in. And it shows that emotional drumming can activate parts of the brain tied to empathy, sometimes even more than talking. So in a way, drumming might be offering us one of the most powerful emotional tools to communicate these languages, just as we heard before with Barbara Holmes. And I want to ask you, if you have the experience of this healing power, and you were already mentioning some of these now, of the drums, and if yes, if you can tell us an anecdote.
Mm. Yes. Well, first of all, like when we play, we're connected to something that makes people move. And I think that's healing. Dance is connected to drums. People get up, and whether they move in time with it and feel that kind of pulse, or a lot of times people just dance freely when they hear something, especially in jazz. So that the desire to move is already healing because we're moving away from being stagnant to something that puts us, you know, in this universal flow. And there's a movie called Alive Inside. It's a documentary that I highly recommend to anybody that's interested in this kind of thing, because it really shows you, like, there are people in nursing homes that are just kind of drawn, withdrawn, haven't moved, haven't talked in months. And then they put Walkmans on, headphones on them, and they specifically try to access, or, you know, through their relatives, the music of their youth, the music that they, you know, responded to. And in so many cases, people that hadn't walked, they got up and danced. People that hadn't talked, they sat upright and spoke. And it's just the most incredible documentary I've ever seen, because it's actually showing you this in real time. So the power of music healing in that way is so, the evidence is all there.
Absolutely. You know, I want us to hear Professor Rolf Tanzi, who is one of the leading voices on the fight against Alzheimer's disease. And this is what he said about the mystery of music being safeguarded even from Alzheimer's beast.
So it turns out somehow, so Alzheimer's disease pathology, the plaques, the tangles, the inflammation spreads through the brain. It goes from the short-term memory area, the hippocampus, through the next area, the temporal lobe, eventually to the long-term memory areas of the frontal cortex. So that's why patients might remember the day of their wedding or high school, but they can't remember what happened 5 minutes ago because the short term goes before the long term. But as this disease pathology spreads kind of like in a circle in the brain, in the middle of that circle is music memory, and it stays untouched, just miraculously stays untouched. And music memory stimulates the hippocampus, the short-term memory. So you may have a hippocampus that's no longer being stimulated, you know, to give context to sensory information coming in from the world. But the little circuit that brings music to the hippocampus is still fully intact. So here's a person who may be almost vegetative, unresponsive to the world, and they hear music, and that music memory directly stimulates the hippocampus, and they're alive again, alive inside. It's exactly right.
Isn't that fascinating?
And even for me, if I have a headache, this has happened to me so many times. If I have a headache for any reason and I have to go play, and the last thing I want to do is hit a drum or hear something loud. As soon as I start playing, it goes away. It actually is this is the medicine that's better than taking an aspirin. You know, as soon as I start playing, it goes away. And I don't know, sometimes I guess I would think before that was just mind over matter, because when you play, you are in the present, you know, at least for me. My mind doesn't go anyplace else, which is such a gift. And I think that is a spiritual place.
This is absolutely spiritual, because being in the present means you are eternal.
Yes, yes. I wrote a song called The Eternal Present. So that's funny that you said that. That was, you know, many years ago. It's on a Gary Thomas album. But yes, the present means eternal.
And do you see the supportive qualities of your mentors reflected in you in the way you mentor other musicians?
Absolutely. Like I was mentioning before, the idea of being non-hierarchical is super important. That's something that I really did learn from all of these great mentors, especially Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock. Wayne would not say, like if he were doing an interview and somebody said, "You're a drummer, such and such, such and such," he would say, she's not my drummer. You know, she's a drummer for the world. You know, she happens to be playing with me right now, but she's not my drummer. And so just that little thing makes me think about that. Like I never say, "Oh, my bass player or my saxophone player." You know, occasionally I say my students, but that's, I say that probably kind of often, but that's
I think you have a pass there.
Well, yeah, I say it because of it's pride. When I say my student, that's always coming out of pride, you know, pride to be connected with this young person that I believe has talent or is doing things. So much of what I've learned, you know, one of the big things, you know, I quote Wayne Shorter all the time with my students. And one of the big things that he said was, "Music is just a drop in the ocean of life." And, you know, and even actually more practical things, like if you're in an uncomfortable situation or someplace you don't want to be, you know, Wayne, you know, and for me at the time he said this, it was a hotel room that I didn't like. And he said, "What's one night in the eyes of eternity?" So there's so many things that I pass on from the various mentors, you know, including Jack DeJohnette and Wayne and Herbie.
But Terilyn, you were also born with a certain character.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very well grounded, I think. And you, as we've heard, you started playing very young, at 7, you said, and you were already performing with big bands. And there's a great anecdote about you meeting big band drummer Buddy Rich, which you tell a lot in your interviews. And I'm sorry if I have to ask you to please tell it again, because maybe some of the people hearing the podcast haven't heard about it. Would you mind telling it?
Sure. Well, when I was 10 years old, I had my first professional gig. Clark Terry brought me to Wichita, Kansas, for the Wichita Jazz Festival. And there I met my longest close friend, Diane Reeves. I was 10 and she was 19. And we were both guests of Clark Terry. Buddy Rich was playing there, and I wanted to meet him. And people said, well, no, just wait. Don't talk to him right now because he's in a bad mood because his flight was delayed, etc. And he was in view, you know, he was not too far away from me. So for whatever reason, I went up to him anyway. And so as they saw me going up to him, they said, oh, buddy, this is young Terry. She's a guest with Clark Terry. She plays drums and she's a guest with Clark Terry. And he said, oh, yeah, well, you better not be any good. And my immediate response was, oh, yeah, well, who's going to stop me? And he just kind of...
And you were 10 years old.
Yes. And he just paused for a moment.
And he loved you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then he said, hey, kid. He said, hey, kid, you want to play with my band?
She's a keeper.
Yeah, he asked me to play with his band immediately. But my parents wouldn't let me because they didn't want to take anything away from Clark Terry, who had brought me there. So, but he happened to come to Boston a few months later, and he did have me play with his band. And then he arranged for me to have endorsements with Zildjian Cymbals and Slingerland Drums. So from that moment on, I've been endorsed by a company. And that's really thanks to Buddy Rich.
Yeah, you know, when I heard this story, for me, it was clear, a clear indicator of how grounded and confident you were. And I think people are born that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, but do you believe this sort of, I don't know, genetic code, the way that you are naturally equipped for life, do you believe this has provided you with a natural strength to advocate forcefully for gender equality?
Well, you know, that's interesting because that natural strength that I have made me a good candidate to excel or at least just be counted in the jazz world because the jazz world is so hyper-masculine. It's so male-dominated. So the women that have been successful in jazz are women that are able to assimilate, are able to be just enough like the next guy, and definitely able to play like the next guy. So whatever, you know, masculinity is in the jazz sound, women had to embody. And those are the types of women that have been successful. So at some point, you know, so when people used to talk about this kind of thing to me, I would say, well, just, you know, practice, just be good, just, you know, just plow through and do your best. And if you do that, you'll be seen. I can't guarantee you'll be rewarded, but, you know, you'll be seen, you'll be noticed. And then one day I realized that women shouldn't have to assimilate. Women shouldn't have to play just like the next guy in order to be considered good. We should be able to actually embrace a feminine aesthetic in the sound coming out of a female body or a non-binary body or a trans body. So once I started wrapping my brain around this concept, I realized I had been looking at it all wrong. I had been teaching all wrong. And I decided to, try to turn the page and do what I could to contribute to this collective movement of looking at jazz and gender and trying to address it both scholarly, you know, with scholarship and also with performance.
This is said very easy, but those structures, this way of thinking, they're embedded in our collective consciousness. This hierarchical and authoritarian exercise of power, they're really embedded in ancestral survival mechanisms either. Mm-hmm. And now I'm thinking about structures like the pater familias in ancient Rome society. And this was a system in which the eldest male of a family held both social and legal authority over the household. And this allowed him to make decisions about his family members' lives and property in court and in public. And I think through history, these structures have provided for security in many ways. But in many others, they have also turned into a hotbed for abuse. Mm-hmm. And we have obviously inherited these structures, and the meaning of these structures live in our, as I've said, collective consciousness. So in terms of gender equality, although we see many women integrating into male-dominated spaces, climbing the ladder of these traditional structures and becoming, I don't know, heads of state, distinguished scientists, and so on, they still, in many cases, have to choose between two options, as I see it. Either renounce to their womanhood, as you were saying, or accept sexualization. Mm-hmm. And in the world of music, specifically of blues and jazz, when do you think were women truly recognized as musicians?
Well, you said a whole lot there. There's a lot to comment on. I mean, I love how you put that. You said that women have to either renounce their womanhood or succumb to being to sexualization.
Yeah,
that's really amazing because, I mean, that's just well said. I love the way you articulated that. I feel like in my case, I didn't want to do either, you know, or maybe I wanted to do both in some way. The point is having that choice, you know, being whoever I am. Bernice Johnson Regan, who founded the group Sweet Honey in the Rock, she said, I am what I am at this particular moment, and that will have to be sufficient. So, you know, if we're talking about an oppressive society, the big thing is that men want to control this narrative of women. And so that's why we have, you know, we have things where women are claiming, you know, their sexuality. And we're talking about not slut shaming and all of these things. Women are saying that they're non-binary because they don't want to have to deal with either. So I love this place that we're at in society, even though it's not, you know, like all of society. But I love this place we're at. People are rejecting the binary and rejecting other people controlling their narrative when it comes to gender and sexuality. But back to your question, I think I got off track from your question. But as far as women being recognized as jazz musicians, I'm not sure. Some would argue that that hasn't happened yet. You know, there were always women playing. There was always talent. A lot of it we didn't know. You know, a lot of it, you know, was suppressed, you know, due to whatever, family, kids. And the biggest reason is it not being fun for women because there's too many barriers, extra barriers and burdens that women were facing in jazz that their male colleagues were not facing. And there's countless stories of men saying, oh yeah, this girl was in my class or my sister was more talented than me, but then she went in another direction, did something else with her life because they didn't have that support. You know, men were deemed geniuses almost immediately if they were, you know, innovative and great, right? But, you know, women were not. So you have the few women that, like you said, climbed and broke through these structures, and then they became the exceptions. And then that's a problem because, you know, we shouldn't point to the exceptions and say, well, there was this person, there's that person. And so, you know, what do you want? And we have to look at the top, the elite, and the best, and all the way down to the average novice player. And women should be allowed that same spectrum of ability within the music. You know, we should have women at the top and we should have women that are your, you know, local musicians. And we should have more women educators too. We just did a study, our institute. I know that we haven't exactly talked about it yet, but I founded an institute at Berkeley, the Berkeley College of Music. It's called the Berkeley Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. And we just did a study in collaboration with journalist Lara Pellegrinelli, and it revealed from her research with at least 200 universities that have jazz programs that only 8%, if we take away the vocal departments, because women have always sung and have always been accepted as such, but when you go to instrumentalists, there was only 8% of women as jazz educators in this country. And when you add jazz vocals, it became 15% or something like that. But 8% is pretty dismal, pretty bad. And it just goes to show you that things, you know, as things are getting better in some areas, they're really not getting that much better. And women educators and not just women educators, but educators that are understanding the importance of gender justice are so important, because those are the, especially middle school and high school, those are the times when women quit. And those are the times when they can really encourage another sound in this music. You know, they're not going to be just about, I need the high notes, I need the strong notes, I need the loudness, I need, you know, all of these hypermasculine things. You know, if we can get these high school and middle school band directors, as well as college professors, to understand that another aesthetic is actually needed in the music, because jazz also is very low in the consumption of music in the United States. It's around 1.5%. So that's a huge reason to start thinking about all this differently.
But of course, this path to awareness, it's very personal in general. Because I remember, like, in law school, being in law school, I was tempted, you know, by this path of achievement. And you'd start very young to play. Were you not tempted to become the best drummer in the history of jazz?
Oh, yeah. When I started playing, that's what I thought I wanted. But then at some point, I was like,
and do you?
No.
I like to ask you, what aspects of your personality do you recognize now? Of your personality, individuality, and womanhood that we were talking about, that you can say now, you are now aware that you suppress in order to fit into these social structures?
Well, I think that's the difference with me and so many other people. I didn't feel like I suppressed very much. I was able to be myself, but myself naturally was the kind of woman that was accepted in these circles. You know, I was a tomboy, but feminine just enough that it's not offensive. You know, I could hang out, I could curse, I could drink, I could do all the things that they wanted to do and kind of be head to head, but I still had, you know, a certain nurturing quality and a certain, you know, kind of normative feminine quality of doing things in a way that they felt comfortable. Like, I wasn't cursing them out. I wasn't, you know, being louder, bigger, stronger than them, even though inside, you know, I was, but I had a way of presenting it that felt acceptable. And that was just where I lived naturally. And so then I realized that women shouldn't have to be this type of woman to succeed in this art form. And I started thinking, actually, I did a gig with Jerry Allen and Esperanza Spalding. And we talked after the gig one night, and they were both saying that this was the first time that they felt totally comfortable, that they felt like they let a guard down, you know, in this all-female trio that we put together, that they weren't feeling like this guard was up to avoid, like, being sexualized, or that somebody was, you know, that didn't have the inner voice saying, oh, you know, they don't like the way I play, or they're just, you know, looking at me, you know, they want to hit on me, and, you know, all those kinds of things, and able to just let that guard down and just play the music. And I felt bad because I didn't feel that. You know, I'd say, oh, I've always felt like, you know, I can just play, you know, whatever. And then I started thinking about it more after this trio disbanded. And I started seeing, yes, maybe there were some things that I had suppressed having to do with my femininity, though I always did feel seductive with the way I played the drums. You know, I think.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain quality that really seduces the listener. So I was never, even though I play very strong, I never felt like, you know, just hit somebody over the head as hard as you can, you know, with rhythm or with sound to pull them in. I always felt like there's like a seductive aggression all at the same time. But I still felt like in a crunch, I had to be able to slay. I had to be able to lead all these men. I had to be able to be more powerful than them. Mm-hmm. And that would just come out naturally at the moments that I felt like it needed to. And then when I listen to other drummers that I like, you know, other male drummers that I like, and especially, you know, from a younger generation, I don't see that pressure on them. Like, I don't see them having to do that in the same way that I did. they're actually able to have more patience with that. You know, they're able to hold back and see what happens. And so the fact that I didn't made me feel like I was having to prove something. So I think that was the big thing, this feeling that never left, that's still there, that I'm still working on, a feeling that I have to prove something, you know, prove why I'm here.
And all of these exchanges with women musicians probably make you aware of the different colors that women bring to life.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, I have so many women friends and women friends that are artists. And yes, we have those conversations. And women bring a lot of color. I mean, we need, and, you know, again, not just to speak in the binary, but we need the color and the ideas of people from the entire gender spectrum. That's what makes life interesting, you know, if we're speaking of gender. And culturally, too, you know, we need all of these things to be a part of the cultural conversation of now, you know, of today.
Absolutely. And you were talking about this study that you did through the institute you founded, the Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice at Berkeley. And, you know, also talking about the spaces that still remain subtly closed to women. It was under the leadership of the first woman president and today president emerita of Penn International and acclaimed poet Jennifer Clement that the groundbreaking Women's Manifesto proclaimed that for women to have free speech, the right to read and the right to write, they need to have the right to roam physically, socially, and intellectually. Mm. So let's listen what Jennifer Clement meant with this.
I couldn't ignore the fact that I was the first woman president of Penn International, and therefore I felt it was important to address the place of women writers in the world, even in the English language, where is the greatest privilege and the most prizes and the most possibilities for publication. Even there, we found out 98% of women who win prizes, their books are, the protagonist is a man. We also discovered that very rarely is woman's writing compared to men's writing, and almost never would a man's writing be compared to a woman's writing. So these biases are sometimes very obvious and sometimes very subtle. So it has to do with freedom. So that manifesto begins with the frontiers, the idea that literature knows frontiers, and says that for women almost at one time everywhere, and now in most everywhere, the frontier for a woman was the doorway of her parents' house or her husband's house. That was her frontier. You know, we see it in Afghanistan. You know, girls are not allowed to go to school. The girls that wanted to go to school in Iraq that were poisoned. These are the extreme places where women have no freedom to learn. And the other thing that was important to me about that part of the manifesto also is that the next line is there are few societies that don't see with hostility a woman who walks by herself. So the woman who walks by herself is almost always the prostitute. But for example, the night belongs to men. And in terms of literature, I mean, of writings that I have loved have been, for example, Borges's Nighttime Walks Through Buenos Aires that are beautiful poems. And Octavio Paz also wrote about his nighttime walks. And I realized, you know, there isn't really any literature of women being able to have nighttime walks because we can't move in the night. And so that's interior freedom and exterior freedom.
Clement talks about the night, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but in the jazz scene, at least publicly, the first women taking part of the night scene were artists, astonishing voices, blessed with divine talent, but nevertheless in many ways sexualized, as we were saying before, and reduced to entertainers or cabaret singers. Then that was too a men's right. You have Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, Bessie Smith, and so on. So my question is today, how can we create spaces where women can gain the confidence to recognize their potential and contribute to the world, bringing their unique perspectives as women?
That's the big question. And that's the work that we have to continue to do. Obviously, I tried to create a space at the institution that I teach at to do just that. But this has to be on the consciousness of so many people and so many entities in so many different spaces. In music, I would say that these kinds of incubative spaces would have to be at universities and, you know, academic institutions. But so much talent never even goes to these academic institutions. And the birth of jazz was, you know, within the community. And this kind of education has been shunned. And I don't know, it feels almost non-existent now. So I think we as creative artists have to really continue to go back into the community to help foster these kinds of spaces and to be intentional about making these spaces for young women, for young girls, because you have to learn this early. Because the habits that you learn in elementary school and middle school are the habits that carry with you. And then it's really hard to undo so much of what has happened already. So, I think that artists and institutions both have to be more aggressive in going into communities and creating those spaces in their workplaces.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with Cece.
And Terry, you were talking about including everybody. And so I want to ask you, in your experience, what about men in the struggle for gender equality? What has this meant for them, for men, liberation?
The liberation won't happen unless men embrace it, because the oppressed can't be the people alone doing the work to free themselves from oppression. Just like race in America in 2020 with the George Floyd reckoning, you know, that happened in the United States, it was the first time that so many white Americans got involved and spoke up against racism in this country. It was a beautiful moment in our history, actually, of unity and, you know, and in the midst of a pandemic, but a beautiful moment in our history. And that's what's needed in all male-dominated spaces. But when I think about jazz, it's not until the men in the jazz community fully embrace this notion of hyper-masculinity in jazz and male-dominated jazz artists and groups that is problematic. You have to see it as problematic. If not, you see jazz as a sport, you know? You know, you see it as men's work. It's so antiquated and it's so backwards, you know, in thinking that. So a lot of the work I do is like one-on-one conversations, you know, small, intimate conversations with people, you know, male leaders that are highly respected, to make sure that they're, you know, seeing this. And once you point something out to somebody and once they see their own blind spots, it's difficult for them to unsee it. So I feel like this work is penetrating, you know, in a way, and that men are trying to take more responsibility because they don't want to be left behind. They don't want to be on the wrong side of history. So it is important, but also teaching young men how to think differently is important. And what I've noticed with our institute is it's like about 50% male at the moment. And I try to not make it more because there's just more men playing jazz, trying to learn jazz at Berkeley. But it's hard to keep the 50% of women involved. But most of these men are rejecting this hyper-masculinity in the music. So they're seeing it as a burden to themselves and them not being able to be their full selves while they carry that kind of burden. So I think that that's incredible. And I didn't expect that. You know, I think it's beyond a male sympathizer or ally. It's beyond having allies. It's actually recognizing that I need this too.
Exactly. And how important it is to break patterns of behavior that pass from generation to generation, that, as you say, are burdens also from those carrying those weights, mm-hmm. and especially those of abuse, in which the oppressed often turns into an oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say something. I mean, you have been honored with 4 Grammys, 2 of them for Best Jazz Instrumental Album. You have performed with some of the greatest voices in jazz, Diane Reeve, Diana Krall, Esperanza Spalding, and also you have been a leader of groundbreaking projects. But I think that the founding of the Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice at Berkeley is one of the most important contributions you have made to the world of music. Because with that institute, you have created a place to liberate the mind, a space to relax where people can create freely. And with that, you enable the interaction and interconnection among young and old musicians, men and women, as we've been saying now. And I think that has resulted in amazing fluid projects being produced. Was that your intention from the beginning, or was that discovered later as you witnessed throughout the development of this institute?
Well, yes, I think the original intention was to create a space, a physical space, and metaphorically a space where women could be their authentic selves and learn about this music and learn how to play it or to talk about it and, you know, learn the history of it, all of those things, without those extra burdens that we speak of. So that was the original intention. But as you have an idea, you know, it evolves, it changes as it happens. The biggest thing is you get involved, you get in there, you start to do the work. And as you do the work, what blossoms is generally something that you couldn't have imagined fully. And what blossoms helps guide you into the next phases of the work. So it evolves into what it's supposed to be and what is needed at that moment. So, you know, we could have a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. I don't know, you know, if we made one, if we met those goals, you know, because I feel like I'm always just following, as I said before, this universal energy that guides me and tells me what's needed at this moment. So I'm not your most planning-oriented person. I don't say, this is what's going to be, this is how we're going to do it. I just get in there and try to, you know, do what feels right to get to the other side.
Yeah, well, let alone this making, well, changing the life of so many people. I think that alone has its own weight and has its own legacy.
Because it's a ripple effect. I think that's the thing that we have to realize. We can do something small, and that's going to create a ripple effect. And so I always try to tell people, don't, you know, it's important to shoot for the stars and to do big things, I think big, but it's also important to make small accomplishments toward a shared goal. And that's, that accomplishment creates a ripple effect.
Well, you know, that speaks about humbleness and that speaks about love and compassion into that space of creativity that you were talking about in these exchanges of not trying to dominate, but also collaborate and just being an instrument to make that change.
Absolutely.
Right?
Because we have to, I feel like we have to look at each other, you know, as equals. Nobody's life is more important than somebody else's. And if the world could see that, we wouldn't have these wars and things going on.
Absolutely. Terry, there is one book created and curated by you called The New Standards, 100 Lead Sheets by Women Composers, which I would like to put as an example of these fluid projects. And we were talking about this fluidity. And when I got into research this book, I encounter a book that is not just a songbook. I think it's a radical reframing of the jazz canon because, first of all, it spans across genres. Mm-hmm. Then it goes into, I think, 100 years, like 1922 to 2022, right? And then it also spans identities and gives spaces to voices that would have been excluded from traditional jazz before. And also a very nice thing that I found about it is this freedom to imagine and to present things differently. Like there's this avant-garde styles that are presented. Like there's one...
graphic score?
Yeah, there's one, this graphic score containing notes and little hints. And there's also another that is even written without bar lines, mm-hmm. which I found very nice. Tell us about the creation of this book and how it led to a performance documentary, an art installation, and later a Grammy-winning album.
Yes, well, it was simply addressing a need in our community. There's so many people that were saying they would play songs by women, but they didn't know any, or they didn't know where to begin to look, because all of the standards that we play in jazz were written by men. Sometimes, occasionally, women lyricists were involved, but the music in general is written mostly by men. In what we called the Real Book, which is a book of standards that was kind of the Bible of people learning how to play jazz, there was one song written by a woman, one standard called Willow Weep for Me. But otherwise, most of the music was by male composers. So when we started our institute and had an event, and I asked our students to play something written by women, they had trouble finding a common, you know, songs that they knew. So that became our first initiative, really just addressing this problem. And then I kept thinking of how to expand on this idea of, as you said, you know, just a new canon, and not really to replace the old canon at all, but to just incorporate women's voices in the existing canon and to have alternatives to the existing canon. So I thought about having an exhibit around this theme. So we invited some artists to make art around the theme. I did a few things myself. You know, it wasn't just visual art. I did some oral history, like excerpts, and you see, you know, these women, you see their pictures, you hear music, and then you hear their voices telling their stories. You know, we did some films, this one on new standards explaining that. I invited Carrie Mae Weems to do a film on the theme, and she actually picked me as a subject, which was, you know, beautiful of her to do. I wasn't expecting that. I collaborated with a great visual artist, Micheline Thomas. I wrote a piece called Seen Unseen, and she created visuals around that. So there's just a lot of different things happening. It's been in Detroit, in Boston, and in Washington, D.C., hoping to bring it other places. And then, you know, I made an album because I wanted to draw attention to this subject matter. And luckily, for me, the album was nominated and proceeded to win the Grammy a couple of years ago.
Fantastic. And this creativity, fluidity, and flexibility isn't just artistic, because it resonates deeply with how our brains can heal and adapt. And in this sense, science shows that drumming and rhythm don't just express emotion, they actively reshape the brain's architecture. A 2020 study by Muriel Brookhaig and colleagues found that just 8 weeks of drum training leads to lasting structural changes in the cerebellum and cortex, areas vital for movement, planning, and coordinating, highlighting with this that rhythms to transform both mind and body. Given this connection between musical fluidity, imagination, and brain plasticity, I'm curious, have you ever been involved in projects that bring rhythm and music into hospitals, schools, or community spaces? Or is this something you'd be interested in exploring in the future?
Yes, I haven't done a lot of that, and it's definitely something that I'm interested in exploring in the future. At our institute, we do outreach. Right now it's to high schools, but I want to expand that into hospitals or nursing homes and places like that, but we haven't gotten there yet. I have done a little bit around the idea of going into prisons and around the idea of abolition. And I feel like it's connected. It's not necessarily healing in the same physical sense.
Oh, I think it's totally healing. Absolutely.
Yes. So that's, something that's important to me. There's I'll send you the link later, but there's, Visualizing Abolition. It was during the pandemic, and it was a distributed symposium that lasted online for about, an academic year from, say, September to May. And every month, sometimes twice a month, but in general, every month, there would be a discussion on abolition from different perspectives. And then I would create music for it and ask different people to be involved. I'd create some myself and then ask other people to contribute music along these themes. So if somebody's interested, if they looked up music for abolition, it was at UCSC, University of California, Santa Cruz. You can find a whole series on that. So that's something that I was interested in that's related to what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's amazing. And we will post it in the episode's description for sure. And we have been talking this whole interview about magic and the beat of a drum and how magic is in every heartbeat. And I would like us to hear a last excerpt from our series, Gods. This is Dean Radin, one of the world's most important scientists studying consciousness. And he's renowned for scientifically investigating paranormal phenomena. His groundbreaking work reveals how our awareness and intention don't just observe reality, but actively shapes it, unlocking what many call the true magic underlying human experience.
If it turns out that the human mind in some way, or especially consciousness in general, as a way of knowing, if that combined with the other aspect of consciousness, which is agency. In other words, it's not simply that we know stuff, but we can think stuff, we can do things with our awareness. If you take this combination of awareness and agency, and that is wrapped into the physical world in some way, in terms of how it behaves, that is magic. That means what's going on inside your head, even though it's really not just in your head, but what goes on in your awareness and your ability to do things is being expressed in the world. How is that not magic?
With that in mind, could you put in words the magic that emerges through drumming?
Yes, I mean, what he just said about awareness and agency being magic was, made me think about, yes, and that's been so much harder, of course, for women who may have had the awareness but not the agency. And, that's a big part of the work that I'm dedicated to doing. So I feel like it's bigger than the magic that I find on the drum kit, or I find within the drums, or functioning within a group, or presenting music. I mean, there is a magic there, and I actually use that term all the time. I say, we're searching for this magic. And even when I'm producing records, I keep changing things and keep working on the production, keep editing it, adding to it and taking away until I find the magic that I'm looking for. And I don't know how to describe what that is other than when I hear it and feel it, I know it. So that's another form of magic that happens on stage or when producing a record for me. And just sitting down to the instrument, feeling like I'm a vessel from something, a part of something else that is not just me. That is very magical. That feeling, when you're in the flow and nothing you do is wrong. And because even if you make a so-called mistake, it's not wrong. And you're able to turn that into something musical, into an offering of some kind. That's all magic.
That's pure magic.
Absolutely.
That's pure magic. If you could craft a legacy from your music and work, what is the lasting impact you would most want to leave behind?
Goodness. I guess really just that, I care about people you know, I did my best to show that and to encourage and support others, to help others see the best in themselves. And when we do that, I think we're contributing to world peace. Because when you can truly see the best in yourself, from a deeply spiritual place, then all the evilness and all the things trying to bring you away from that, a lot harder to do. So that's what I've been mostly concerned about. How do we improve and expand? How does humanity improve and expand? And how do we individually contribute to that? So I think that all the things I do a lot, different things that, aren't related to drumming, all of those are still moving to the same goal.
Professor Terry Lynn Carrington, thank you for having reshaped modern jazz by championing equality through experimentation and collaboration. You're not just one of the best drummers of our time, but a timekeeper, a fantastic storyteller, a fighter, and a healer.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. This has been a really beautiful conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. For me too. And thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. Shall you wish to follow Terry Lynn Carrington's steps, learn about her projects and music, check out her webpage at www.terrylynncarrington.com or follow her in social media. All proper credits for Terry Lynn Carrington's music, which we've heard throughout the episode, as well as other important information, can be found in this episode's description. See you next time. Bye-bye. Supposed to be